Thank you. Be seated.
The court is ready to hear argument from petitioner in Continental Coffee versus Cesars.
May it please the court, Mr. Martin Whitcliffe will present argument for petitioner. Petitioner shall reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May I please support the opposing counsel? My name is Martin Whitcliffe. I'm from Houston, the law firm of Clifton Hall. And my co-counsel, Paul Hash, and I are representing the petitioners, Continental Coffee Corporation, and non-documented appeal to court. This case has a lot of importance to employers in the state of Texas. It has even more importance to employers who have businesses in Harris County. And we have brought before the court three issues which we would like the court to consider and reverse the Court of Appeals in the decision that it's made. The first point of error that I would like to discuss with the court, and I'm going to try to reserve 5 minutes per point of error, but of course I will entertain questions from any of the justices. But the first point that is of most importance to us, especially those of us who work in Harris County, is to what extent does the county court at law in Harris County have the jurisdiction to entertain retaliation discharge cases? And I'm going to loosely call it retaliation discharge cases, but we commonly refer to them as workers' compensation retaliation cases, primarily because those persons who have been on a compensation leave or who have instituted proceedings under the comp statute and who may then be fired, there is a special provision in Article 8307C that gives them protection. And that's where we need to start, is look at 8307C and what does that statute say about which courts can entertain these kinds of suits. It says very specifically, and by the way, the 8307C provision is a provision that was in act at the time that this particular scenario of facts arose. The case was tried at a time when the code, the statute had been recodified by the legislature in September of 1993, but the incident arose under the old 8307C. And I'd like to focus the court on that because the language of that statute is very specific as far as we're concerned about which court is to entertain these types of cases. And the statute very clearly says that the district courts shall have jurisdiction to restrain violations of this statute. We think that simply means that if a claim arises that is considered to be a retaliatory discharge, that the district courts of Texas have the authority and are given that exclusive authority. We say that it is exclusive, though the word exclusive is not used in the statute, to entertain those kinds of causes of action, and no other court, including county courts, have that jurisdiction.
So do you think it was just an accident that they put the words to restrain in there instead of the word concerning?
Well, I think it's a word of art that was used very loosely, and restrain can mean, of course, injunctions and awarding legal remedies. The Constitution gives district courts the power to enjoin violations of statutes anyway, and we think that was a broad word used by the legislature to encompass not only injunctions but legal remedies under the statute. But once you start with the premise, and we assume that that is the correct premise, that the district courts have that authority, then we need to look at the legislative grant of jurisdiction to the county courts in the state of Texas. And under 25.003, there is a grant of jurisdiction to county courts that is fairly broad, that talks about county courts having the same or concurrent jurisdiction, or having concurrent jurisdiction of the district courts, but with certain dollar limits. But when you look at that broad grant of jurisdiction, the legislature, with this infinite wisdom, decided that it would then look at the various counties in Texas to decide on an ad hoc basis which counties should be given, which county courts in particular counties should be given more authority or specific authority, or have some authority taken away from those county courts, based upon the workloads of district courts, for example. In Harris County, we have 25 civil district courts that don't have any criminal jurisdiction. We have probate courts. We have family courts. And so there is an enormous amount, a number of courts in Harris County to undertake these kinds of cases. In El Paso, if you look at the El Paso statute, basically says the county civil courts at law in El Paso have the same jurisdiction and can hear the same kinds of cases as district courts in El Paso, pretty much giving the county courts the ability to hear and entertain any type of case that the district court can't. But when you look at Harris County, under 25.1032, there is a specific grant of authority that's given to the county court. And one of those, which has been repealed in 1989, is subsection B, that up to 1989 gave concurrent jurisdiction to the county courts with monetary limits. In 1989, the legislature totally revamped that and removed the concurrent jurisdiction for county courts in Harris County and took that away. But then in subsection D gave specific grants of authority to the county courts in Harris County over real property, corporate forfeitures, a number of six specific delineations of authority that the county courts in Harris County would have. In that delineation, there was nothing mentioned about retaliatory discharge cases, not one single thing. But the court, the legislature still allowed the county courts in Harris County to entertain appeals from the Texas Workers' Compensation Commission. That was specifically given to them in that statute, as well as the general jurisdictional statute. So we think the legislature made it clear that in Harris County, the county courts of law will have certain jurisdiction, and the Texas legislature made it clear that those particular courts would have specific jurisdiction, and entertaining workers' comp retaliation cases would not be one of them.
But we think if they wanted it clear, they very easily could have written it clearly when they granted jurisdiction to the district court. They could have added just a few more words, and it would have been incredibly clear, and this issue wouldn't be here.
Yes. Yes, they could have made it clearer, but our point being, Justice Abbott, that when you look at how these provisions of the grants of authority to the county courts play off against one another, and if you read them together and follow the legislative history and then look at which statutes were repealed, we think you come to the conclusion that the county civil courts in Harris County do not have the authority to entertain these kinds of workers' compensation retaliation cases. One additional point I'd like to point out to the court is that in those counties where legislature has given the county courts the jurisdiction to entertain, by implication, these kinds of cases, the specific statutory grant of jurisdiction will always refer back to the general grant of jurisdiction in 25.003. Noticeably, in Harris County, that introductory language is not present in the specific grant of jurisdiction to the Harris County Civil Courts, leading you to the conclusion that the legislature did not mean for the county courts in Harris County to have concurrent jurisdiction with monetary limits, as you might find in some other counties in Texas.
Whitcliff, we also, some point in your argument, addressed the issue of preservation of error and all the points that you've raised here.
I'm sorry, Justin.
Preservation of error.
Yes.
It is alleged that we have no jurisdiction because you failed to properly preserve the points.
Well, Your Honor, that is something that the other side has brought up a number of occasions, and a lot of what they're bringing up is for the first time in this court. Jurisdiction is an issue that can be brought into the Supreme Court for the first time. It was brought to the trial court's attention the first day of trial and raised in the Court of Appeals, and that will bring it before this court and asking you all to make a pronouncement about that. But we think there was no preservation of error needed specifically on jurisdiction, but certainly we did raise it at the trial court level and at the Court of Appeals.
You're so sure about this argument that you not preserve your argument that there was a sham to get around the $100,000 monetary limit.
We have alleged that. Yes, we have alleged that.
But you don't allege that anymore.
No, we do not.
And if there is jurisdiction, the court were to find there was jurisdiction in the statutory county court of Harris County, then you would not be making any argument about the dollar amount.
No, we would not.
And this case would be, if for any reason it was remanded, it would be remanded back to the statutory county court.
Well, if the court found that there was no jurisdiction, then...
That question again was premised on if we found there was jurisdiction.
If you found that there was jurisdiction, then points two and three, however you would decide them, if you found them out of favor, would be remanded to the county court for reconsideration, yes. Our second point of error deals with liability. We believe that we preserved error on liability. We have raised that issue a number of times, starting with our proposed findings of fact and conclusions of law that were filed in the county court before the trial. After the trial, we asked the county court judge to submit findings and conclusions. She had to be reminded to do that, and then she finally filed them. And after she filed findings of fact and conclusions of law, dealing with the facts and conclusions that she found, that we requested the court for additional findings and conclusions, and very clearly went through each one of hers to ask the court to make additional findings and additional conclusions. So we think that error was preserved there on whether or not there was legally sufficient evidence to support the verdict. We raised that in the Court of Appeals very clearly and in the motion for rehearing. We talked about legal sufficiency issues, and now we're raising it here before this court. And we don't think there's any question that we have preserved error in raising legal sufficiency. We believe that when the court looks at, and this is what is so critically important to employers in Harris County, and why if you let the Court of Appeals decision stand, 90% of the employers who operate in Harris County are going to feel like they can't do anything with anyone who has filed a complaint. When you look at the types of facts that the trial court and the Court of Appeals relied upon to support a conclusion that there's been a violation of the statute, any employer is going to feel like any employee who filed a complaint or who's hurt on the job, whether they're a subscriber or non-subscriber to the statute, or they say they're going to get a lawyer, invoking the protection of 8307C, that person becomes bulletproof. You can't talk with them about how they're doing, like Mr. Duff did. You can't talk to the carrier to make sure that the benefits are being paid. You can't do all the things that the court found in support of this judgment that Mr. Duff did. For example, let me just run through these for a minute. Knowledge of the claim. The Court of Appeals takes great pain to say that he had knowledge of the claim. Well, every personnel and individual is going to have knowledge of the claim. The supervisor is going to have knowledge of the claim. To use that as a factor to support a liability finding, as far as we're concerned, doesn't get you where you need to be. Negative attitude. They cited negative attitude very generally as asking on the employment application, have you ever filed a workers' comp claim? And getting into those kinds of issues that the workers' comp statute permits employers to get into so that you can get into secondary liability issues.
Counsel, doesn't your client primarily rely upon what it says is a facially neutral absence control policy?
Yes, we do.
And since this is a bench trial and that there were 80 different findings of fact here, that were appended to the respondent's brief. You have the burden, of course, to show there's no evidence to support critical findings. For example, the judge found that that the plaintiff was never made aware of the existence of this absence control policy. And so you have the burden to show that there's no evidence to support that finding, correct?
Well, we made it clear in the trial court through our own witnesses that Ms. Cazares was a member of the bargaining unit of employees that were represented by the Chemicals Workers Union. And in that collective bargaining agreement, there is, in fact, a provision dealing with the three-day no-call, no-show rule.
She says she didn't see it, and that the trial court found that as a fact.
Well, she said that she didn't see it. But if you're a part of the bargaining unit of employees, it is up to the union to educate the employees about what is in the contract. And we are to assume that she has knowledge of what the no-call, no-show rule is. She said that she didn't know it, but if you're a member of the bargaining unit of employees represented by this union, it is to be assumed that you are aware because that is an obligation placed upon the union to educate its employees.
So even if she didn't actually know it, she's charged with knowledge?
She's charged with knowledge of it, just by being a part of the bargaining unit employee.
And the trial judge also found that it was not uniformly applied and should not be applied to people who are on workers' compensation disability benefits.
Yes, the trial court found that it was not uniformly applied by referring to an employee by the name of Karen Walker. And the reason why that is important as far as we're concerned as employers is that that is not a true comparison of persons who are similarly situated who don't have protection. For example, Karen Walker was on a workers' compensation leave of absence. And to compare her against what happened to Ms. Cazares is comparing apples and oranges because both of them are protected in the protected act category of having filed a workers' compensation claim. What the court should have done, or what should have been presented by Ms. Cazares, was to look at persons who were on non-workers' compensation leave of absences and how they were treated vis-a-vis this three-day no-call, no-show rule. That is the comparison, because this is a discrimination statute. 451 deals with discrimination. That is the first heading. In order to show discrimination, individual by individual, you look at the disparate treatment. You can't show disparate treatment by looking at persons who are in the same protected category. You have to look at persons who are outside of that category and see whether or not the rule was applied differently to those persons.
If I may ask one question about the third point of error.
Yes.
Since we said in Morial that the standard that in that case does not apply to intentional conduct cases, what standard should we apply in determining the legal sufficiency of a punitive damage award in this case?
I think Morial demonstrates that the court is looking at evidence that's fairly egregious, that's punishing people for doing something that has evil intent, so it's set an example of what shouldn't be done in other cases. If the federal statutes have likewise borrowed that type of reasoning when dealing with intentional violations, and all the discrimination statutes and the U.S. Supreme Court has said you've got to show intent to discriminate. But even if you show that, you can collect punitive damages if you show something over and above that. Show malicious conduct, evil intent, evil motive on the part of the alleged discriminator. We're suggesting to the court that at a minimum, the court should apply the standards in Morial dealing with the subjective and objective criteria of determining whether the facts are so egregious as to warrant punishment, and to borrow the analogous reasoning of the federal appeals courts and the U.S. Supreme Court about the types of standards that are required under the 1991 Civil Rights Statute. There have been a number of cases decided that deal with under the circumstances where you can collect punitive damages, even where there's been, you prove, an intentional violation. Where the intentional violation gets you to liability and compensatory damages, but that doesn't automatically mean that you get punitive damages.
Finding of fact 80 says that the termination misconduct occurred intentionally, willfully, and maliciously.
Yes.
That doesn't support a punitive damage award.
We're saying that that is the conclusion she jumped to where the facts are legally insufficient to support that conclusion. When you look at the facts, they don't warrant that conclusion. She listed a number of innocuous facts and then jumped to the conclusion that it supported punitive damages. And we're saying that that's the kind of conduct that would that doesn't support the rationale of awarding punitive damages in this state or any other state of the United States.
Any other questions?
Thank you.
Thank you.
The court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Richard Hogan will present argument for respondent.
May it please the court. Your Honor, the petitioners argue that this is a case that's very important for employers in this state. We'd like to submit to the court that this case is not something that this court should sit in trying to balance equities between employers and employees, but this court ought to sit to further the legislative purpose that's established in the wrongful discharge statute and the workers' compensation laws. If that legislative purpose is to be furthered, this court needs to affirm the Court of Appeals. Now, we in this state have said that there is a legislative policy, a public policy, that we want people to choose the remedy of workers' compensation. We have taken away from people their right to sue their employers directly for negligence. To further that legislative policy, to keep employers, in fact, safe from civil lawsuits alleging negligence, this state says you must take workers' compensation if you're hurt on the job. And if you elect to take your workers' compensation remedy and can then be subjected to the terrible and egregious acts that were performed in this case by Continental Coffee, in Ms. Casares' case, that legislative purpose will be totally undermined, it will be ripped away, and people in this state will then have fear in exercising their legislatively enacted prerogative of taking workers' compensation benefits.
Is there any significance under the bargaining agreement to the letter from the doctor that released her to go back to work? Does that provide any sort of significant event in the application of the bargaining agreement?
Two answers to that question, Your Honor. First of all, the collective bargaining agreement doesn't talk about a three-day and you're out policy. The collective bargaining agreement, and that's cited in the petitioner's brief, the collective bargaining agreement is entitled Termination of Seniority. And it says that if you are gone for more than 3 days without calling, your seniority status is terminated. That is not the same thing as what's cited in the work rules. So the court should not be misled that the collective bargaining agreement somehow creates a trigger point for a three-day firing. It doesn't. It creates a trigger point for seniority revocation. Now the second answer to the question.
What does that mean? What does seniority revocation mean?
I'm not exactly sure under the collective bargaining agreement, but typically in a union shop, if you have seniority, you get some better jobs. You lose your rights that are accorded by your seniority status in the union.
Could you lose your current position to someone below you who has more time on? I've got more time on the job than the one below me. I've lost my seniority position, so the one below me is now entitled to take my job.
I suppose that could happen. You could lose that particular place in the plant, but you wouldn't lose your job under the termination of seniority status. Now that's in the record, and certainly the court's free to look at the bargaining agreement between the union and Continental Coffee. But my second answer to your question, Justice Enoch, is this, that the three-day no-show, no-call rule that you lose your job, there is a triggering event there. And the release from the doctor in this case, under the pretext reason given by Continental Coffee for Ms. Casares' firing, the pretext reason in this case is that she didn't call in for 3 days and that she was released by her employer on October the 28th. I've passed out to the court an oral argument exhibit, which I believe shows why that is a pretext reason, and also these reasons will also support the causal connection between the firing and her filing of a workers' compensation claim. First of all, she was not released to return to work by her doctor finally until November the 18th. She was fired on November the 8th. If you simply look at the calendar, you see that there is an inaccurate and a misreading of the record in this case by the suggestion that October 28th or November 4th was the trigger date, as Justice Enoch mentioned in his question. That simply is not correct and a fair reading of the record. Secondly, even if October 28th...
I'm sorry, I want to be clear. There's a direct statement, I think, by Continental Coffee that there was a doctor's statement that said she would be released to work on October 28th. And I thought the whole argument was she just didn't have a brace or something and this was kind of interfering. But you're saying that that is an incorrect statement. The record shows that the doctor's release was November the 18th.
That's correct, Your Honor. We cited the pages under first point. If you look behind tab 1 in the oral argument exhibit, you'll see what Mr. Duff has when he said that she was released to return to work on October 28th. This is the specific and subsequent medical report that Dr. Parsley in Houston filed. And it says not that she was released to return to work. In fact, that section is left blank. This is Defense Exhibit 3 in the record. That blank is left blank. In fact, she says that the part that's filled out is item number 23, anticipated date the employee may return to work. And that says she should return to work on October the 28th. That's also attached behind tab 2. And behind tab 2, is the piece of evidence that Mr. Duff had when he decided that she was released to return to work. This is what he testified to was the basis of his assumption that she was released to return to work on October 28th. You see
does
the
that,
reason?
And that's, does that show the type of, does that meet your standard for punitive damages?
Your Honor, it meets
your standard. Should return on this date of return.
Not in and of itself. That's evidence that the three-day rule was a pretext.
Okay, when we get back to this, I know. When we get to punitive damages, though,
I'll be happy, Your Honor, to leave the argument on pretext to this exhibit and to the record in the case, because the best evidence of pretext, I'll simply conclude that point with this fact, is that Karen Walker, instead of being terminated after being absent for way longer than 3 days, if you look under the tab 5, you'll see the letter that the Continental Coffee people wrote to Karen Walker. She didn't get terminated after 3 days. What she got was the right to go to her doctor and ask for a note from the doctor explaining why she wasn't there. Now, that's disparate treatment. That is not the application of a uniform and neutral policy of absence control. That is, in this case, a different treatment for a worker who had filed a workers' comp claim and was given the chance to redeem her employment. That's not neutral, and that's not even-handed.
Let me ask you this. Do you think that punitive damages are warranted in every single wrongful discharge case?
No, Your Honor, I don't.
So the mere fact that the employer terminated her is insufficient to warrant punitive damages?
Yes. That fact, standing alone, we'd lose.
So what makes this case worthy of punitive damages?
This case is worthy of punitive damages, Justice Abbott, because you have different conduct than simply the termination. I'd like to point the court, first of all, to the fact that the employer reported to the Texas Employment Commission that Ms. Casares voluntarily quit. This employee benefits director, Mr. Duff, had it in.
Hold on a second, because those facts and other facts that I'm going to guess that you were about to recite are evidence that support that they didn't just terminate her, but they terminated her because she had filed a workers' comp claim. Okay, that's the evidence that you need to establish actual damages. And then it seems as though you need evidence more egregious than that in order to warrant punitive damages.
I think we have not only more egregious evidence, but we have different evidence than simply evidence that they fired her because she filed a comp claim. We have evidence that they turned her into the work to the Texas Employment Commission as a voluntary quit, which thereby automatically causes the TEC to not give her unemployment compensation. She not only loses her job, but if you voluntarily quit, you're not entitled to unemployment compensation. That is an entirely different kind of conduct than simply termination.
So what they did caused her to suffer additional property damage?
Additional economic damage. And when you look at the inferences that can reasonably be drawn from the record, you have an older lady with an eighth grade education who's got a son at home. In that kind of circumstance, for that person, that is the equivalent of the financial ruin that Justice Cornyn talked about in Morio. It is foreseeable that the employee benefits director knows that if he reports voluntary quit to the TEC, she not only will have no paycheck, she will have no unemployment compensation check. That's different. That's different conduct that is egregious. That is the ill will, spite, and evil motive kind of state of mind that this court recently in the Texas beef cattle case cited as justifying the imposition of punitive damages. You went back and you looked at the Clements versus Withers case. That is ill will and spite. They had it in for this woman. She filed a compensation claim, and it wasn't enough that they would fire her because of that. Mr. Duff went further, and he said, you're not only going to get fired, you're not going to get compensation checks from the TEC. Now, they will argue in rebuttal that the voluntary quit is a definition that's stated in the workplace rules. However, it is preposterous to suggest to this court that Ms. Casares voluntarily quit when she was taking notes to the employer from Dr. Parsley asking to be reinstated, when she was meeting with the company vice president asking to be reinstated, and when, in fact, her son had told her employer that the reason she was out on November the 5th was because she had been to the doctor. It is simply preposterous to report that she voluntarily quit.
Who did her son help make that statement to?
Her son made that statement to Maisie Villarreal.
Did Maisie Villarreal, I'm sorry, I can't pronounce your name, but did she visit the home that day?
Yes, she did, Your Honor.
Did she talk with her son but not with her son?
That's correct. And Mr. Duff said that a report by a family member to Ms. Villarreal, who then in turn reported that conduct to Mr. Duff was enough to void the absence control policy, this three-day rule. Also remember, Your Honors, that Mrs. Casares specifically denied ever having told her employer that she would return on November the 4th. That's, again, a pretext. But to go back to the argument on punitive damages, because that may be something perhaps that the court may be interested in, you not only have malice, and you can look at the findings of fact and see the kind of egregious conduct that we're talking about here. You have malice in this work, in this TEC example that I'm talking about. You also have malice in the sense that they knew that this lady was 1 year away from vesting in the company's retirement plan. So if they could unload this worker who's making $14 an hour as a custodian, that is going to...
Can we consider that after Ingersoll?
I think you can, Your Honor, unless this case somehow comes under some kind of an ERISA breach, which we don't think it does. There's a Supreme Court case that was decided this year, and it's cited in Texas Torts and Remedies. I'll get the cite for you. It says that kind of conduct's not preempted. You not only have that type of malice to support punitive damages, you also have fraud. These people are lying about the three-day rule, as my oral argument exhibit shows. It's a pretext. That's fraud. There is also fraud by virtue of the fact that Ms. Casares was never told, if you don't come in and you don't call in for 3 days, you're going to be fired. That's fraud by failure to state. And that is an independent tort, different than the wrongful termination tort, which is a statutorily enacted tort.
So what you're saying is that the defendant in this case would have been better off, instead of trying to dance around the issue, if they had just told the plaintiff, look, you filed a comp claim, we're going to fire you.
Well, you know, only Perry Mason gets those kinds of admissions at trial, but certainly she would be better off. She'd have direct evidence of the wrongful termination.
No, what I'm saying is the defendant would be better off had they just come out and said from the very beginning, you filed a comp claim, therefore you're fired. Instead of dancing around the issue, which you're claiming they did, because they danced around the issue, that warrants not only actual damages, but punitive damages. But had they been direct about it and said, you're fired because you filed a comp claim, then they would be entitled, the plaintiff would be entitled to only actual damages and not punitive damages.
I'd say, Your Honor, that they would be better off in the sense that there wouldn't be this other egregious conduct, but we don't just have the fraud by failure to state something. We don't just have the lack of a direct statement here. We have direct actions that they were openly hostile to her workers' compensation benefits. They were openly hostile to her TEC benefits. And it wouldn't be better for the employer if they would have just said, Ms. Casares, you're fired because you filed a comp case. That's the kind of intentional conduct which we would say, under the legislative policy enacted in Texas, this court ought to further by allowing the imposition of punitive damages, with that intentional conduct plus the fraud plus the malice.
Are you saying that there needs to be some qualitatively different harm other than the harm that sought to be protected by Article 8307C in order to justify the recovery of punitive damages? You cite the denial of TEC benefits, and I'm wondering, are you making the argument that there has to be qualitatively different harm, or you're just saying if there is, does have to be qualitatively different harm, that qualifies?
I'm saying both, Your Honor. I'm saying that, yes, in fact, we have qualitatively different harm. We have evil state of mind that guided the evil hand in this case.
What is there anything else? If qualitatively different harm is required, is there anything else other than the TEC benefits?
The TEC benefits, the specific fraud that they engaged in this case, the failure to tell her that she was going to be terminated if she didn't come into work, and her qualitatively different harm in terms of a financial ruin. She had no fallback position. She had no TEC benefits.
Is it in the record that she, affirmatively in the record, that she did not get any TEC benefits?
I'm not sure if that's affirmatively in the record, Your Honor, but that is not important. The consequence of that action is not as important as it is to show the evil will or the spite or the malice in this case. The answer directly to your question, Justice Cornett, is that it's helpful to have qualitatively different harm. That's certainly helpful, but it is not necessary if the courts to follow and further the legislative policy of trying to encourage people to elect workers' compensation remedies.
Mr. Hogan, with regards to the issue of the three-day no-call rule that you say is a pretext, I assume that it was not. Focusing on the knowledge of Ms. Casares, or lack of knowledge, Whitcliff argues that that is immaterial because the union has the duty to inform her, and she's presumed to know everything in the collective bargaining agreement. What is your response to that?
My response is that's probably right. But if she was charged with that knowledge, it's constructive knowledge in the first instance. But secondly, the specific knowledge that she would be charged with is that her seniority status would be terminated, not that she'd be fired. That her seniority status would be terminated, and that's qualitatively different than being fired and being told that if you don't call in for 3 days, you're going to lose your job.
You don't know exactly what seniority status means. Can we find out from this record?
I think you can, Your Honor. The entire collective bargaining agreement is Exhibit 1. I think it's Defendant's Exhibit 1 in the record. It's my understanding that in those kind of union shops, that the termination of her employment is not mentioned in the collective bargaining agreement. In fact, the brief filed by the petitioners in this case cites termination of seniority. It says termination of seniority and other rights. But that does not mean, in fact, that she is charged with constructive knowledge that she's going to lose her job.
Would you speak for any of your remaining moments to the jurisdictional issue and whether Harris County is somehow unique?
Yes, that
well, we'll take judicial notice is unique, but is it not subject to the general jurisdictional scheme of the Uniform Statutory County Courts Act?
It is subject to that general jurisdictional scheme. Let me say briefly my answer to that is the Court of Appeals got it exactly right. If you look at page 75 of the Court of Appeals opinion, you'll notice that even if we must rely on the specific grant of jurisdiction to Harris County Statutory Courts, in that provision, in provision C, it says, in addition to other jurisdiction provided by law, we argue that that provision relates back to the general county court of law jurisdictional grant, and Mr. Whitcliff has now conceded that he doesn't challenge the $100,000 limitation in statutory county courts. So the Court of Appeals got it right. Specific statute refers back to the general, and finally on jurisdiction, before I sit down, I'll simply say that the legislature did not create exclusive jurisdiction in district courts. If they had wanted to, as Justice Abbott correctly pointed out, they certainly have pen and paper and could have written that into the statute.
Any other questions?
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Whitcliff, let me ask you a question. Let's assume that we were to rule in your favor on the issue of liability concerning actual damages. Why would that not send a signal statewide that in these types of cases, perhaps in any type of case, that the Supreme Court is going to be reviewing evidence in every case, and regardless of what a 6-person or 12-person jury did, you always have a 9-person jury at the Supreme Court who can reconsider the evidence?
Well, I think the message that you were sending is it's going to take more than these types of innocuous facts for a plaintiff in a disparate treatment case, which is what this is, to be able to meet their burden of proof to show that there was, in fact, discrimination being practiced against that person. If the court were to look at facts like in Ramirez, and some of the other court opinions of other courts of appeal where there have been really relatively egregious facts that can only lead to a conclusion that there was in fact discrimination, we don't think your reversal of this case will affect the types of cases that have been decided by the various courts of appeals in this state in terms of the quantum of proof. Hines' decision that was decided last June, I think is an example of how the court has, under a whistleblower statute that has language similar to ours, where it uses the word because, the court reevaluated the quantum of proof as necessary and decided that because in that statute means but for. Because in this statute ought to mean but for. But for Ms. Cazares engaging in protected activity, i.e. in this case filing a workers' comp claim, she would not have been fired. And that is the exact same type of burden of proof analysis, shifting burden of proof analysis that all the federal courts have used in discrimination cases. This is a disparate treatment case, and under the facts in this case, disparate treatment has not been developed
in this case, to the extent that there should be liability against his lawyer.
But the burden of proof standard would be different than the...
I'm sorry?
The burden of proof standard would be different from the standard about whether or not there was some evidence to support the verdict.
Well, the proof would... You, the court would be enunciating a standard of proof that would be analogous to what the court has done in Hines and what the various appellate courts and the U.S. Supreme Court has done in the various civil rights statutes in this country. So we're asking the court to reevaluate the legal sufficiency of the evidence and set the standards, write an opinion that tells all employers and the courts of appeals what is going to be required before you can find liability. And based upon this evidence and this record, it does not meet that. It really doesn't meet the quantum of proof that the other courts of appeals in this state have decided is necessary to meet your burden of proof. We're asking the court to give the courts of appeals and employers and employees in this state guidance about what is going to be necessary. And all you've got to do is borrow what you did in Hines and what the various courts of appeals have done in civil rights statutes.
How do you answer the argument that 3-day rule only applies to seniority, not determination?
Well, the 3-day, that provision is not unlike a lot of collective bargaining agreements where if you break a rule, a work rule, which there was a work rule in this case, and it's also in the collective bargaining agreement, that nomenclature of you lose your seniority is equivalent to termination. If you lose your seniority, you don't have a job within that company.
What does it not mean that you're not going to get promoted?
Well,
you're going to be passed over for promotions, like City of Sherman.
But to say that you're going to be passed over for a promotion doesn't equate to any loss of seniority. When you lose seniority in the union context, you are out of a job, and that was the intent of that section of the collective bargaining agreement.
And
there's no other provision.
That definition of seniority is in the agreement?
Yes.
That you're terminated when you lose seniority.
It's our interpretation that because there's no other seniority provision, termination provision in the collective bargaining agreement, it's my view that Mr. Duff made it clear that if you violate the no-call-no-show rule, that loss of seniority provision comes into effect, and then you're no longer employed there.
Why doesn't the information that Maisie Villarreal got satisfy the no-call-no-show rule?
Well, because when you look at the record evidence that even counsel provided to the court this morning, all Maisie Villarreal's all that Mrs. Bizarre's son told Maisie Villarreal when she went to visit was, "I'm not feeling well today," or "she's not feeling well today." Who knows what that means? The respondent did not develop that in the trial court to indicate or conclude that I can't come in. There was no direct overture by Cazares or her son that I will not be in today. And that is what is affirmatively required of any employee who's out. You've got to call in or have someone call in for you to say, "I'm not going to be in today." What? So to say I'm not feeling well today doesn't mean anything. A lot of people go to work not feeling well.
What does the reference show one way or the other about loss of loss of TEC? Did she get them or not?
I don't recall exactly off the top of my head, and I was at the trial court level, and I apologize for not being able to give you that answer, but I can provide that to the court post-submission. But what Mr. Duff did at the TEC was say, yes, she voluntarily quit. That's what the rule says. If you don't call in within 3 days, you are considered a voluntary quit, and that is in the work rule. So he was not misrepresenting anything to the TEC or anyone
where
else.
Where in the record is that work rule?
The work rule is exhibit, I don't know off the top of my head, Your Honor.
And that is not part of the agreement. This is
The work rule is a separate document that's posted in the workplace that mirrors some of the same language that's in the collective bargaining agreement about infractions.
Are the work rules in the record?
I'm very sure they are, Your Honor.
Any other questions? Thank you, sir. That concludes the argument in the second clause. We'll now take another recess.